Welcome back to another episode. My name is Jeremy Strike. This show traces the lines on exceptional people from their roots all the way up to where they are today, because it's important and it can help us see the same patterns in our own lives, point us in the right direction. Today, I have Nick Quinton, who is an expert at this. He's a paratrooper. He was in the British military and is now a health wellness coach for entrepreneurs. Nick is a wealth of knowledge. He has amazing book recommendations, movies, podcasts. His philosophy is just very nuanced, and I'll let him elaborate more on that on the show. I hope you all enjoy, and I'll let Nick get to it. Cheers. Welcome, Nick Quinton, to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here with you, Jeremy.
And so Nick Quinton, for everyone listening, he's got a pretty decorated career. He was in the Army in the past. He was a consultant. He is now a health and life coach, fitness coach for entrepreneurs. Nick, let's start at the beginning. You know, you're from Corfu, Greece.
Yes.
So that's like a small island in the Mediterranean. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I you can start anywhere, can't you, with these stories. And yeah, so my father's from a very small village on an island in Greece. And, you know, massive contrast in one generation. So when I look at my father's life and my life, it couldn't be more different. Like very, before tourism hit Greece or anything like that, his life, he grew up and he had quite a rough upbringing, actually. Hmm. So he was interesting story. The village I'm from was up on the hill, a beautiful old Greek village, really, really traditional and just absolutely stunning. They suffered quite a serious earthquake back in the early 50s. And they evacuate the whole village down into the lowland.
Yeah.
And there were real struggles within my family, because we weren't one of the wealthier families, one of the poorer families, in terms of my grandfather passed away, and my granny was left with three children, mm-hmm. and she couldn't feed them all. So my father was, my auntie was old enough to work in the mm-hmm. field, effectively. It's kind of hand to mouth. She was old enough to work in the field. My uncle was too small to be sent away. So my father was sent to an orphanage, and that sort of cultivated his kind of character and his upbringing. It's a really interesting that aspect of my father's upbringing. But yes, I'm from a small, very small village in Greece. Lived there till I was six. Mm-hmm. And then my mother brought us to the UK. And she's from England.
Yeah.
And grew up on the south coast of England, which is absolutely beautiful, and through the English school systems and that sort of thing, and kind of consider myself a very mixed bag of half Greek, half English. Also have some Danish heritage as well.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the start of the road, I guess.
Yeah. Well, mixed cultures makes people interesting. Mm. So we're gonna jump all over the place through time and. Mm-hmm. Whatnot. Tell me about the first time you jumped out of an airplane.
So in the military, I was in the parachute regiment, kind of airborne forces. And we're designed to sort of not use our brains too much and kind of fall out of planes. I'm stupid enough to jump out of planes is probably how some other units would describe us. But yes, I think that was my first time. To get into that unit, you have to go through what's called an arduous course. It's considered an elite force, so you go through this very physical, very arduous process to get in. And then, kind of, once you graduate through that, you get sent away to parachute school, and you get trained how to military parachute, which is very, very different to any recreational fun skydiving. Completely different. Yeah, couldn't be more of a contrast. So. Kind of, and I've skydived since that, Skydiving is fun. You go very high. You have lots of time in the air. Military parachuting is pretty much the opposite of that. You're very low. Yeah. We jump at 600 feet, so it's 200 meters above the air, above the ground. The canopy deploys automatically, and you hit the ground within 15 seconds, and you're hitting the ground at almost 30 miles an hour. So it's a very, very, very hard landing. So that was my first experience. You do all the sort of ground training stuff, and then you jump up there, and you jump out in very strict formations. So the idea being, you know, the capability is that we can drop a large number of soldiers onto the ground very, very quickly. So you're all stacked up, all one in front of the other in a dark aircraft fuselage. The door opens, you can't really see what's going on. Red light and green light on, and everyone kind of shuffles forward. There's even a cadence. You follow the cadence of the person in front. You kind of basically shuffle forward, and there's two guys by the door that just pull you out, basically. So there's not a lot of enjoyment in that process.
It's just kind of like designed to turn your brain off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like a lot of things in the military, they get very mechanical. They don't, you know. So when we overthink, that causes a time lag, doesn't it? And potentially an elastic time lag between taking action. Training is designed to remove that. So you see something happen in front of you, and you react. You're not thinking.
Yeah.
That's the whole mechanics of it, and I think that's what makes soldiers have a sort of quite dynamic skill set that is quite hard to replicate, because they've gone through that process of train, take action. So that was my first experience. Never been one for heights, which I think is why I challenged myself. In the parachute regiment.
Yeah.
So that first time was pretty nerve-wracking, but like I said, it's probably one of the better ways to do it, because you're not spending lots of time pondering. You're mechanical. You do the training, and the training is kind of your step by step, paint by numbers, and you literally march out the door. It's funny. So, and then you're presented with a nice fresh air, and you've got about 20 seconds before you hit the ground quite hard. That's it, really.
So what, you were afraid of heights, so like what pushed you to be a paratrooper?
Good question. I think, so I'm not, like I was never a sort of big tough guy. I never thought of myself like that growing up as a kid. I was very shy, very retiring, and kind of withdrawn, and you know, low level of social skills, not particularly academic, so nothing that kind of shone, really. And I think I had a very weak narrative because of that, and because of the turbulence in my childhood, kind of moving around a lot, being away from my parents. So, you know, I almost felt like I was starting on the back foot. And I think that aided me to push myself into situations where I was going to be really, really challenged and confront my fears. And that's kind of what's led me down lots of different paths, I guess, in life. But for sure, it's what pushed me to the military. Also a sense of belonging. And pushed me to take the challenges on that I took on, and seek out the tougher situations, the tougher people to be around and challenge myself against, and face my fears. And you know, innately, lots of people are scared of heights, but we'll kind of back away. And I think without realizing it, somehow through my sort of very mixed upbringing, I've developed a kind of a muscle in my brain to seek out things that are actually going to push me through and lean through those fears, which I guess can be very valuable. I guess there's probably a danger to it as well, but yeah.
Well, there needs to be some danger.
I don't know if I answered your question there, but
So Nick has his own podcast, everyone listening.
Yeah, I do.
The Elemental Health podcast.
That's right, yeah.
So he was about to ask me a question. Feel free if you want to. one thing you mentioned that I think about a lot. And you mentioned community, right? And camaraderie. And so I was an athlete, and I tend to draw a lot of
comparisons between the military and athletics, mm-hmm. like when you were talking about turning your brain off, mm-hmm. right? It's obviously an exaggeration, but the best athletes are the ones who are able to do this and just like trust their training. Mm-hmm. And that's actually where I kind of drew, you know, the short stick. It was like, I could not anymore. You know, my head was getting too involved in the game. And that was when I had to like pull away from it. You know, and this sense of like teamwork and community, it gives you that kind of like security to not feel like I have to do this all, you know, I have to be like individual. And I'm just wondering, you know, in this like modern, and we were talking about it a little before we started here, you know, in the 2019, almost 2020 world where, you know, people are all over the place and this community is like you're interconnected, but it's not like nearby. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this camaraderie is changing, community is changing? And do you think that it's for the better, for the worse? Like, what's your opinion on that?
So this is something that I think about a lot, actually. It's funny, you go through these sort of processes and you speak to someone, it's not until you articulate, and this is very much a coaching model, mm-hmm. And unless you articulate something, you don't really think about how it's connected in your head, which is the value of kind of having these conversations. So I think I innately was seeking a community, a sense of belonging all through my childhood and into adulthood. And I think that's inherent in every human being. We want to belong, and that's probably the strongest force that we've got in our life. And that's, it can be incredibly powerful, especially in today's modern age, where you can kind of reach pretty much anyone on the planet. But the danger is you want to belong to the people who don't promote your best interest, perhaps. Mm. And there's some obviously extreme examples like that in kind of gang culture, where people want to belong. They don't have a home life, so they want to belong, and they see these icons in their local community. And that's what they see. So that's what they think, okay, I want to belong to something. What's meaningful? This is, I'll go towards that. And then there's a sense of identity around that that gets enhanced and that gets built upon. And that leads down a certain path, which we're all very familiar with in terms of, you know, the narratives that were presented to us from Hollywood. Okay, it's not always like that. But, on a more general terms, I think people... want to do what other people are doing, and that can be really problematic, because when it comes, from my perspective, when it comes to health, you want to form you've got your community of people, and you know, culturally, certainly in Western culture, we're very much kind of like, oh, we go maybe have an alcoholic drink together to socialize, sure. or maybe we'll go for a meal together. And also the identity around taking shortcuts and the easy options when it comes to your health and fitness and being lazy. We like to socialize that.
Yeah.
And that's a real problem, because breaking away from that and actually saying, no, actually, I don't want to just sit in front of the telly. I don't want to have another takeaway meal, or I don't want to go to the pub. It becomes really difficult because of that sense of belonging and that sense of that's, your identity is inherently linked to that. That getting way too deep into it. But so that's what I see as the challenges we face. But the benefits, kind of guys like yourself, millennials that are kind of all over the place, meeting loads of different people, expanding their networks exponentially and massively more so than maybe 10, 20 years ago, through technology, through, you know, what technology's led to in terms of like shared working spaces, and people be willing to connect even if they don't know, like, you know each other like we do. And I think there's huge positives to what technology has allowed us to do. But I think so, being part of a community is inherent to all of us, and we all do it. But I think some of us are very unconscious about our choices around the community and the sense of belonging. And some of us are not. Some of us are much more, I'm going to select which communities I'm being part of. So it's kind of, again, kind of a split in the way people view it.
Yeah. There's so much there.
Sorry.
Oh, man. So there's a couple things, and we'll come back to, you mentioned like sharing a meal together. So obviously you're a trainer and health coach, so we'll talk about that more. Your fasting experience and things like that. But yeah, a couple things that you mentioned. First of all, like the whole millennial, like kind of scattered all over type of thing. I can tell you personally the positives and negatives of it. I mean, it's a lot of things that you mentioned, mm-hmm. but technology has enabled us to be kind of like all over the place.
Yep.
So we do that and you don't have this community, right? Or you're in a community and then you have to leave it, you know, and that hurts.
Yeah.
That really hurts. So it's sort of this like dynamic where you have the ability to be in a lot of different communities, but sometimes you just need to be in one community for a little longer to get deeper in.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, yes, you want to strengthen those connections, don't you really? And that's when there's so many connections that becomes impossible. And I think, you know, the we're talking about human behavior really, aren't
yeah.
we? That's what it kind of all so boils down nice. To. Yeah, and I think we know that small teams are very effective and have really strong connections and strong nuclei, whatever the right term is. And the bigger the team, the weaker the connections become. And that's the challenge, I guess, that
yeah.
we're faced with now.
Have you heard of the Dunbar number?
It rings a bell.
Yeah, so it's actually, how big was your, like, platoon or whatever, how do they describe your in the military?
So that's what I think the military get really, really right is,
yeah.
So I was, you know, it starts with a small number and then it builds up
yeah.
to a bigger picture. So I was part of a fire team of four men.
Mm-hmm.
We were part of a section of eight. So, you know, four was really strong.
Yeah.
Eight was strong.
Yeah.
And then we're part of a platoon of 20. Mm-hmm. Again, really strong connections. And then we're a company that had four platoons in, and it kind of scales like that. So, and with each step up, the connections are weakened.
Mm-hmm.
So the four guys around me, I trusted with my life on a daily basis
yeah.
When we were on operations. And we got those eight. My section, again, I trust them to a very, very high degree. But platoon, again, very strong connections, but it starts to get diluted. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised the numbers you said there, because like the company, I mean, I would guess, I know a lot of military companies are modeled around this Dunbar number.
Right.
Is 100, not exactly 150, but like they've traced our roots back to, she's a neuroscientist or psychologist or something, and she traced the roots back to like hunter-gatherer days, and the tribes, they had their like small, close-knit, you know, it was like your family, and then, you know, your like immediate survival groups. But then when you're traveling like as a pack, it would be in the like 100 to 200 range.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that 150 is the number that like the human brain is like most comfortable with having like deep human connections with.
Yep. Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, sounds right. I think, you know, my simple brain might even struggle with that size of number. But
well,
yeah.
It's all, I mean, we're all the same, I think.
Yeah, but again, I think it's concentric circles, isn't it? That would be my kind of take on it from my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you've got, and I had a really interesting analogy. Nassim Taleb, I think, was talking about, you know, our political allegiance is designed around the number of people involved.
Mm.
So at a family level, probably quite a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get bigger, you probably become, you know, you probably sway from left wing all the way across to whatever your political standing is at a national level. But so depending on the size of the group, depending on your actual, your political standpoint, if you view it in that perspective, do you see
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, at family level, you want to share everything, including your finances.
So what that means the bigger, so like if we were a huge country, it would be more right-leaning, or?
Well, I guess that.
Or your sense of what, like identity?
Yeah, there's a really nice quote that I'm going to butcher, but it's along the
lines
of.
Where were you reading this, by the way?
I think it's his latest book, Skin in the Game.
Skin in the Game,
yeah.
Okay.
I think he says, you know, most of us at family level are socialists, And then at company levels, we're, you know, I'm trying to think of the American terms, but we're sort of
battalion, maybe.
No, in terms of political standpoint, okay. You see what I mean? So yeah, we're sort of, I don't know, at sort of company level, we might be not socialist, but the kind of like mid-leaning,
yeah,
and then in our national level, we might be sort of right-leaning in terms of we want to just do what's right for us as an individual. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, interesting. Anyway. So we'll move away from the like military background. was there anything, so a lot of my listeners are sort of like young millennials that are just kind of figuring it out.
Yeah.
Was there anything that you learned in the military and the armed forces that you couldn't learn anywhere else, or that you'd want to tell people that might not have that kind of experience?
Yeah, I think yes is probably the answer. But what is tricky to describe in words. It's something that I think about because my wife's pregnant and we're having a baby soon. It's kind of like, what if they want to go into the military or not? You know, well, how do I feel about that? And that's sort of interesting triggers in my mind, whether I think that's a good idea or not, which is funny. So I think, are there lessons that, you know, or habits or behaviours that inherently are learned in the military you can't learn externally? I wouldn't say you can't learn them externally. I think they're much less common. And it's that sense, it's kind of what we've been talking about that sense of belonging and sense of single purpose. And I think whenever you describe it like that, people think it's kind of like it's believing in the mission or believing in kind of queen and country, as we'd say. But I don't think that's not the right level to be thinking at. It's those connections of the people around you and that brotherhood and that community. And I this is what people say as well. It's not my own view. It is my views. But it's being willing to die for the person next to you.
Yeah.
That's the tough part of kind of like transposing that mindset into the non-military world, where a lot of things aren't life or death. So you don't have to have that level of buy-in to the people, what the people around you are doing. And the clear benefits of having that sense of team connection are, you know, you don't drop the ball,
right?
Because everyone's relying on you, and that, although intellectually we understand that that's a good thing and we should all be part of a team, we should have a common goal, and we should all want to kind of do everything we can for the person sitting next to them.
But it takes you past the intellectual.
Well, that's it. Yeah. So in the military, you have it at a non-intellectual level. Like most things in the military, you have it at a kind of, it's bred into you, and it's kind of, it's part of the training. You bond through training and you bond through hardship. And business communities, we don't have that. We all have slightly different paths to get to where we get to and how we come together. So it's very easy at an intellectual level to say that's what we need, but to actually transpose that down. And these are the common problems, aren't they, really? It's very easy. We all read lots of books and we say, oh yeah, that's a really good book. But how many people are actually going away and taking action against what they thought was a good intellectual idea in a book? I'd argue not very many. I certainly know that I've read lots of books and thought, that's a phenomenal book, and my life hasn't really changed. You know what I mean?
So it kind of just pushes you to really experience, like, if you value camaraderie and community because it was embedded in you, and now that you're out of it, it's still there, rather than if you're reading a book about community and camaraderie, it's just like riding in your head rather than being in your DNA.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly right. And the lesson there is you need to go out and do stuff. And you need to meet people. You need to risk in relationships. You know, you need to be the person that wants a stronger connection and wants to create a strong team. And that's always, someone's always got to go first in that situation. So that's the kind of lessons learned, I would say.
Are you familiar with Sebastian Younger?
No.
He has a very interesting story. He was like a military journalist, so to speak. He was in, I don't want to say the wrong battle, but it was one of the really dangerous, damaging battles in Afghanistan in maybe like the 2000s.
Yep.
So he had a team, and his cameraman actually got killed in battle. And he writes this book called Tribe, and he talks about community. And one of the big issues when like military people and just anyone, like if you were in a fraternity, you know, like to make it really mundane, you have this brotherhood. And then when you leave it, it's like this feeling of lostness. And you think it's because I had bullets whizzing by my head, or I'm traumatized now because I had, I drank too much in college. But it's really getting away from this core group of people and, you know, losing that sort of identity and identifying with others.
Mm-hmm.
That's like his thesis in Tribe. It's really interesting. He's got a podcast with Joe Rogan.
Has he?
I really enjoyed.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
So you were in the military for 5 years.
Six, I think.
Six years. Okay. And then you moved to London and sort of changed everything. So what happened next?
So I went on operations in 2006 to Afghanistan.
Okay.
I was part of the 3 Parabattle group. We were the first boots on the ground in Southern Helmand.
Yeah.
And it was full on, it's probably how I describe it. It was full on war fighting.
Right.
And we, you know, the line I always remember in the newspapers at the time were, you know, we were in more severe fighting than during the Korean War.
Wow.
At one point in time.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to blow my own whistle, because that's not the point of it. I think it was a unique time, a unique period that perhaps hasn't been replicated with British forces since then. That 2006 tour. And it was an incredible experience for me.
Mm.
I learned a lot, and it was a real roller coaster of emotion, from really enjoying the experience, being exposed to some natural beauty, and also living at the very fringe of existence on a daily basis.
Was it very aware? Were you very aware that you could die, like at any moment?
Yeah, and I think that can be a real positive driver, and it gives you an incredible clarity of mind.
Yeah,
it really does. And that's the uniqueness of that environment.
Right.
It really pulls it all back to a primordial, you're sleeping, you're getting up, you're trying to survive a few hours at a time, and then you're resting. And it sounds dramatic and I guess it is, but it's really a unique way to live. That you can't replicate apart from in that environment, you know. So I went through that process, came back, and I transferred into the regular army from the reserve forces. So I had a fairly easy route out if I wanted it, basically. And I took that opportunity to go back into the private sector and pursue other opportunities. Twofold, really. One, I never saw myself as a career soldier. And secondly, I think I knew inherently we were coming back off that tour knowing that we'd seen kind of what you sign up to see as a soldier. Do you know what I mean? We were there, and we survived it, and we had that experience. So I came back thinking, well, what else is this path going to hold for me? And that led me to moving on into other careers and funnily enough, off the back of that and you know, being away from family and having the tough parts of it and trying to really sort of engage with society, which is always an interesting process, I sought security. And to me, I relied on my sort of educational background and went into the finance sector, IT projects, something that I saw as a sort of corporate structured career that was going to give me that security that I seeked.
Right. So it was kind of just going from one extreme to another. And I wonder, is that like a common thing with soldiers? Is that Do you find that, did have many of your colleagues, like, or not colleagues, but your brothers, whatever you call them, did they kind of go to the other extreme right after?
I guess it's a mixed bag. It really is. It's a really mixed bag. Some people will. Some people go into the city and the finance sector, we call it city, and kind of seek that corporate roots and kind of lean on their leadership and experiences in combat and that sort of aspect to propel them in that career. And others won't. Others will seek much more of an active life and actually stay within the security world,
sure.
even if it's maybe not to their best interest. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I don't think there's a clear path for any of us, unfortunately.
Well, I could see it going both ways, right? Like, you could want to do exactly the opposite, you know, like really correct for what had been happening, or you can want to stay with what's comfortable and like what's common, even if it's like, not saying the military is common or comfortable, the opposite, but that's what you've been doing. So getting away from it is hard.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it takes a certain kind of person.
It's tough. It's tough to leave the brotherhood. It really is. And a lot of people don't do very well coming out of the military. They really don't. You know, we look at the homeless numbers, lots of ex-military, mental health, lots of ex-military have real mental health problems. It is really tough to leave that environment because it is such a close-knit community and you experience very unique aspects of life and potentially traumatic episodes, which you are trained for. But I think if you've got a part, you know, I think it's almost a perfect storm. You see, you get a lot of guys going to the military because they've had a troubled youth.
Yeah.
And then they're exposed to trauma. And that's a potentially quite a dangerous cocktail. And I think there's some interesting research done into that that specific aspect. So I overcorrected.
Yeah. I was listening to a podcast the other day. It was Sam Harris and Adam Grant.
Yep.
And they were talking about how it's like so common that people, they like seek extremes. You know, if I were in the finance sector to start out and I started hating it, I would do exactly the opposite. I would quit and go work at like on a construction site and then start hating that. And then it takes like 15 years, but you realize the medium is where you need to be.
And that's the journey, almost like the journey that I think we all go through. And I certainly know that. So I developed a story, which I guess you're going to ask me about, is so I went into the corporate world and spent 6 years progressing quite quickly and meet some nice people, but ultimately I knew it wasn't the right environment for me. And then I did exactly that. So I went away from kind of money and finance and that sort of stuff and into healthcare and retrained as a paramedic.
So we'll talk about your training and what you do now. One thing I'm curious about, and everyone knows that I love talking about people when they're little. I don't know, maybe it's because I still feel like a little kid, but when you were young, were you a healthy kid? Were you an active kid? Like, you mentioned that you were kind of timid, but was there anything that would have, if you told yourself you're going to train CEOs and entrepreneurs, you'd be like, oh, maybe.
No, I don't think I would have bought into that at all as a kid. I really don't. I had a desire to join the military.
Yeah.
I didn't quite know if I had what it took.
How old were you when that came about?
I would say 9, 10, 11.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
fairly young. Yeah, early on. And I don't know. I definitely wouldn't know then what I was, the journey that I'd be on or kind of how my life would unfold. I really wouldn't. Just to draw on that point, so I don't think I would ever have thought about it either, because I was a very timid, small child. I was very, very active. Always really enjoyed being outdoors and in nature. And then school, I loved sports and playing sports. And rugby was my big sport all through school and into adult life as well. But I was always small and struggled in that forum.
You mentioned that you were small and kind of like needing to prove yourself a lot.
I think so. Yeah. Which a lot of people disbelieve now when I say that, when I sort of talk about this stuff, because they look at my background and they look at me physically and yeah, it's quite a juxtaposition, really.
Yeah. Well, that's again. So, would you have guessed that I used to weigh 235 pounds?
I would not. No way.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. So it's like when you, it's kind of like overcorrecting again too. You know, like you have these experiences, you know, I was super overweight and I was always like an athlete. So I kind of like, I wasn't like obese and just didn't move around,
yeah,
you know, but I was not healthy and I was super pessimistic. And then you have this like start, I had kind of like my first panic attack and my mental state just shifted. And then you go exactly opposite. And up until recently, a couple weeks ago, I was eating like I was overeating health food.
Right.
Like literally, and that sounds ridiculous, but it was actually upsetting my body because too much of a good thing is a bad thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So now I'm realizing like, okay, you can eat oatmeal and stuff like that.
Wow.
But it's just like this common thing, right? Where you overcorrect. And then your body tells you, no, you're being stupid. And then you send you back to the middle.
I think I'd love to know more about that. Your story. I didn't realize that was the case, but I think you're right. And we see that moving into health. We see that in dieting, you know, the outcomes of people on these big brand mainstream diets is so poor. It really is. The statistics of people that actually sustain a healthy weight post diet, as opposed to yo-yoing back up, is like ridiculously low,
really,
like 1 in 1,000 we're talking about here, and that's what the research tells us. Do you know what I mean? But we buy into this kind of like, well, I need to overcorrect, I need to have massive contrast in my life, and it just doesn't work. You need to be step by step. I need to understand yourself, but it all comes down to one word: awareness.
Awareness and patience, I think, as well. You know, because like if you jump, all right, I'm going to be in the ketogenic diet tomorrow.
Yep.
Like that's one of the, in my opinion, the hardest sustainable diets like ever conceived. If anyone doesn't know what it is, it's like basically you get 80% of your, now how about you describe it?
So the body has different ways to fuel itself, is how I would describe it. And most of us, through our history as well, we use sugar as a source. We use sugar as a source of fuel. So we get our calories from carbohydrates, and that's what we tend to use. We convert that into proteins, which then the proteins is what we need.
Yeah.
The other way to do that is by burning fat and metabolizing fat, and through a process called ketosis. So we don't need, or we don't demand the carbohydrate transformation, and we have a complete shift in how our body's fueled.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like any change, it's tough for the body and the brain to understand how to fuel on a different system. It's like trying to run your car, you know, convert your car from petrol to electric. You know, there are going to be natural problems with that process.
Sure.
And I think physiologically there are challenges to it. Psychologically there are challenges to it, but culturally there are massive challenges to it. So I mean, you mentioned it at the start. I did a 5-day fast at the start of this year, and
5-day fast.
Yeah. So 5 days water only.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to me how much I became aware of food in our daily culture and how much we're getting marketed by food production companies. If you live in an urban environment, you probably don't even consciously see it. It's all just feeds into your subconscious, the big brands. I mean, you know instinctively what they mean, what they represent, and what behaviors they're triggering without actually thinking about it. Because if you thought about it, it would work. Because you think, well, that's not going to be good for me, so I won't go down that path. So it's all feeding into the subconscious, and having that 5-day break, I was able to really be aware of how much that is playing on our mind, and how those that kind of brand awareness and then the marketing that's fed into our eyes every single day.
Right.
A lot of it, we just don't realize.
Right. I hate to like push on the consumerism, capitalism button, but like it is our most primal need, probably. I mean, okay, food, shelter,
yep.
sex,
yep.
right? They want to sell you these things. So food is like, they want to sell you something. So food is the easiest and the most available, you know, temptation for a human being,
yep.
the most universal.
Yeah.
So it's just everywhere. And there are people trying to sell you food all the time.
Yeah. And the easiest food source to process into energy is
mm-hmm.
sugar.
Yeah.
So, you know, the mechanics of it are so simple. It's so obvious. But yeah, and that's the challenge we face, really, is you know, and we've created cultures around eating and eating habits, and that's the you know, the breaking away from those cultural norms, and that, like we said, that community to do something slightly different, like go on a 5-day fast,
mm-hmm.
is really tough. It's really tough. Yeah.
So one thing you wrote about in your blog about this 5-day fast was the sense of, you know, when you were skipping a meal and like that longing, you know, and the engagement that we have with eating, you know, with others. And one thing that I'd never thought of before that you kind of struck in my brain is, and for everyone listening, I would wager that none of us, literally no one, has eaten a meal alone in silence before. No television, no radio, just nothing. Sitting there and just looking at your food and eating it. Have you?
No, and that's a really valid point in the health space, because we're not conscious of our habits and
yeah.
what we're doing, and that's a really interesting point, because I think if you did that process, and it's quite a cathartic process to go through, you kind of have all these thoughts, and it's a bit like trying to sit in meditation. You
yeah,
know, the
yeah.
first time you do it, it's really difficult because your head's racing around, you've got these voices, you know, you're just kind of suddenly aware of all the noise that's going on inside your head. And I think, you know, to do that, you're going to be much more mindful of how you eat and what you eat.
What you're eating.
Yeah. But it's, you know, this distraction economy is kind of feeding into us overeating.
Yeah. Well, and I also wonder if it's like the community aspect as well. You know, like if we go back to our roots again, would you ever have eaten? I mean, maybe you might have picked some berries and stuff alone, but if there was like I'm being a little dramatic here, but most of the time you're eating with your family, you're sharing food with others, and it's just like built into us to eat with some other noise or some communication, even if it's television, like that's communication.
Yeah. I guess so. I don't know. I don't know too much about where that's come from.
Mm-hmm.
I think any distraction is probably not healthy, and not going to help a situation where you're kind of trying to make a change.
Yeah.
So if someone's trying to be healthier about what they eat, then being distracted from the task at hand is not perhaps going to help you. So yeah.
So you came out of this 5-day fast. How are you feeling?
Pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
So there are lots of really interesting studies being done at the moment, and this is an area where it's so exciting about the studies that are being done, and the evidence, the weight of evidence, because we're now addicted to science. That's like the new religion, isn't it? I'm sure you've heard that terminology. It's become a new religion, and people are buying into, like, we've got the studies, we've got the science to back something up. Even if it's the most craziest idea and
the science is tenuous.
Yeah, anecdotal at best.
Yeah.
So, but the fasting is, you know, we are seeing some really interesting studies being done, and I think the way I look at things is, you know, we should be taking an ancestral approach.
Mm.
So, kind of think about how we maybe used to live and how that links into how we might want to live now, and also how that sits with us and feels that we feel that as well. And at that point, you can then look at science. Do you know what I mean? I think if you go that way around about things, then you're weighting the outcome in your favor versus kind of listening to what the next guy on Instagram's talking about and kind of following that blindly for 8 weeks and then falling off the bandwagon, following another thing blindly for that. You know, you're on the roller coaster. You need to get off the roller coaster, and the way to do that is to kind of be very stepwise in your approach and think, okay, well, what do I innately think health is? What can I link that to in terms of ancestral roots? So, but yeah, the science is starting to stack up, which is important because we're kind of addicted to the science side of it as well. and the longevity aspects are really interesting. So, you know, I was keen to pursue that and also see how I physically felt. And you know, like a lot of people that report back off after these fasts, first couple of days are quite tough. Your body's trying to switch over, like I said, to that fueling system. So it's trying to fit a switch over to fueling on fats and other waste products in your body. Once you've made that switch, so after the sort of 40, 48 hour mark, you start to feel much better about life. And I went into that last day, so the fifth day, feeling great, feeling really good, really strong, really energized.
It's the last day. It's really interesting, isn't it?
So I've
experienced that a little bit and experimented with some wacky diets and fasting as well. And I just want to give like a warning to everyone as well. Like, you know, probably a lot of you are interested in health and whatnot. It's not, first of all, it's not easy, but it's also like not recommended for everyone. And if you're just going to jump right into a fast, like you think, oh, this is interesting. Like I eat three meals a day kind of thing. That it's really dangerous.
Yep.
You know, you can faint, you can pass out, like who knows? So it's just something to proceed with caution and jumping into a 5-day fast. You know, Nick's like in ridiculously good shape and this is his life, you know, so try eating one meal a day or something like that.
Yeah, I agree. I think be planned in your approach and have an approach. Don't jump into something you don't understand.
Yeah,
of course.
I do that way too often. So we'll start to wrap up. I have a few questions that I ask everyone.
So
do you have any like books, movies, podcasts that you love that have influenced you that you would recommend to a young millennial?
I've come prepared. I do, absolutely. There's so much great content out there. It's really interesting, and it's almost a challenge to kind of consume all the great stuff that's going on in the world, and I think that's quite exciting. But there's some wicked resources, and I could sit here for the next hour and go through bits and pieces I think people should be looking into and doing bits and pieces. But just on what you were saying about fasting and health and that sort of stuff. So, you know, as a health coach, I don't give advice. You know, I am a clinician, but that's not what I do when I coach people. I'm kind of trying to support them in their decision making. And the fasting or the just kind of not eating or time restricted eating, you know, is something that I think I promote quite a lot in terms of the guys that I coach and to just, you know, just think that through and have a go at it in a kind of a methodical approach. So starting like, I guess a bit like you did, starting off maybe like a 20 hour or 18, 20 hour fast, and then go a little bit longer and look into the guys that are really diving into the science, like Peter Attia, Jason Fung, you know, if you're interested in that sort of stuff. So I just wanted to caveat that bit of it. So we're not giving you advice, but ultimately it could be a really valuable thing to be start tapping into. And we know that we overeat. Look at the obesity levels. Yeah. You know, we're overeating. So what is a good solution to that? That feels innately straightforward. Stop eating. And if we go back to our ancestors, and I'm not talking 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years, if we go back 50 years, we know that we ate two or three meals a day and we didn't snack.
Yeah.
And we didn't have food rammed in our face, access to food 24 hours a day, which just didn't happen. You didn't see people walking down the street drinking or eating in the 50s, in the 40s, in the 60s, even. So, you know, that's worth bearing in mind. You know,
it contributes to that mindless eating as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just be more mindful about when you're having a meal and what you're having and why. The analogy I always like, and it's great to get it in on your podcast. The analogy I always like is food is information. So when you're putting a piece of food in your mouth, you are putting a piece of information, you're programming your body, same as you would do at a computer, writing a piece of code, you're then going to stick it into the mainframe that is your body. How is that piece of code going to get interpreted?
Yeah, that's very Western, or very Eastern as well. Like there's so much history that's like, think of all the plants and animals that have, you know, there's a big food chain on that piece of meat that you just ate, you know.
Yep.
They eat a lot of grass, things like that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and going on to that from like historical, I think it was one of the Roman philosophers that said, you know, let food be thy medicine, or medicine will be thy food. You know, and that's it ties in with that beautifully. And I think, you know, worth thinking that, you know, a lot of the guys, I know you've got questions to ask me, but getting back into my story, the reason that I do much more health promotion, health coaching, and kind of getting into working with leaders to try and be healthier is because in a clinical pre-hospital setting, I went up in front of guys that were in their 50s and 60s and had completely lost control of their health. And confronted with that, I was kind of shocked and started to dive more into the science, develop my skill set to try and help people in a different way and have more impact.
Sure.
And that ties in with, you know, what is health and what is that sort of stuff, you know, what is that about? And then that's why I started the podcast, and it's why I do what I want, and it's become my mission is to unpick those decisions that we make on a daily basis that are going to lead us down one trajectory that maybe we're not even thinking about.
Right.
Versus making decisions consciously that are going to lead us to a different health trajectory. And that's kind of how I interpret what's going on. Yeah.
Well, Nick, you have so much to say, so much that people need to listen to, honestly. Yeah. So he's got a good podcast.
I didn't answer your question.
Okay.
What was it?
What's that?
I didn't answer your question.
Oh, no. It was about books and podcasts and movies and whatnot.
Yeah. So I do. I do have a podcast, and I'll touch on that at the end, I guess. But the way I categorize things. Yeah, that's right. Because I was saying I didn't, you know, there's so much out there. But I think it's interesting different ways I approach it. So I like to have a sort of fictional historical type book that I'm reading that kind of takes me away from the present day. And if no one's heard of it or they haven't read it, I would recommend Musashi, which is an incredible story about a samurai in Japan. That book has been read by millions of Japanese people. The statistics on that, the readership of that book is way above, you know, any other book.
Okay.
In Japanese literature. I think it's running at like 30-40% of the population has read that book. It's crazy. So obviously you can read it in English. The other fiction book that I always recommend, it's just a beautiful story about a guy's journey through kind of, and very, very pertinent to your audience, I think, a guy called Laurie Lee, and his book's called As I Walked Out One Midsummer's Morning, and he leaves a very quaint little British village, and he goes on a journey through Europe and ends up fighting in the Spanish Civil War. And it's an incredible story. From a more sort of personal development perspective, I think, you know, Jordan B. Peterson's book 12 Rules is fantastic, and anything by Nassim Taleb is brilliant. The other book that I think is really, really helped me a lot is Bounce by Matthew Syed. And the reason I like that book is because it really dissects the talent myth. And I think we all innately think that other people can do things because they're talented and we can't. And that's the narrative, certainly in my head and a lot of people's head. And that book really dissects that narrative and shows it to be bullshit. Because he goes into how Mozart became so talented, and he goes through, you know, the Williams sisters, and you know, dissects their life, and some chess prodigies that were built by design. You know, the parents said, right, we have kids and we're going to make them chess masters. So there's no, you know, innate born with stuff going on there. So that's phenomenal. I think leadership, Jocko Willink, sort of leading the shining light in that way from my perspective. Also, his podcast is wicked, and he's just quite very dry wit, which I love.
Great voice too.
He's a good guy. And I think the film that I would recommend, I mean, one I saw about a year ago and I've watched it once since, is a film called Jim and Andy.
Yeah. Jim Carrey.
And Andy Cushman. I was blown away by that film. I'm a big fan of Jim Carrey and his philosophy on life as
He's so thoughtful, man. Yeah, it's incredible.
He's out there, and that film in itself, it's not your classic Hollywood fast-paced action drama, romance, or anything like that. It's a really interesting story and the threads in between those two characters that are so interesting. And the talking heads narrative that goes on through the film of Jim Carrey is just phenomenal. It really is. And he touches on so many sort of philosophical, thoughtful, thought-provoking things that just blew me away. So if you haven't seen that, that's it.
Amazing. Well, Nick's got his own podcast, the Elemental Health Podcast. Thinking about starting his online courses. Are you fielding new clients, people in the UK?
Yeah, so I'm doing lots of different things. I'm helping GP practices in the UK work better together. So that's the healthcare kind of family practices, I think you call them, but there are lots of healthcare challenges everywhere in the UK especially. So I work with groups of GPs and try and help them build their practices from a coaching perspective, which is really interesting work. My main business is my health coaching practice. Mm-hmm. And that's developing business leaders to be physically and mentally much more resilient and robust and understand how health and self-care is at the core of everything that permeates around in their life, and the relationship to themselves is primary in that role. So it's really opening those eyes, and that's a really interesting space to be in, and I thoroughly enjoy that. And it's so interesting how different business leaders run their life and the challenges that they face and how the synergies are across the board and we all have the similar sort of struggles as well. It's a very human role, which is why I love it. And I do that remotely as well. And I haven't expanded into the US yet, but it could be on the horizon.
If many people in Silicon Valley that want/need
I'd love to, and I'm working with a guy to try and understand how best to scale it, because I'm only one guy and it's not naturally scalability, although important, because I want to get my message out there. I don't want to dilute what I'm delivering as well.
So where can people reach you on social media?
So I think, if you're interested in what I'm talking about, then please check out my Elemental Health podcast to get a better understanding. They can reach out to me on Facebook or Instagram, and it's The Knock, which is THENOQ. That's probably the easiest.
Awesome. So last question I ask all my guests, and I'm putting you on the spot a little bit. So if you could reach 1 million people tomorrow, your podcast, it's a voice message, it's a text message, something that's on the wall or on the ceiling when they wake up, what would it say?
Be the message, be the change. Mm. I think that sums up kind of what I'm trying to do at the moment and what I'm trying to achieve. And my story is largely, anecdotal in what lies in my future. And I truly believe that, my best work is ahead of me. Yeah. So relying on what's gone in the past is futile. I need to move forward. And the only thing that matters is how you're represented in the world and how you're representing yourself. Mm-hmm. And largely speaking, what we say has very little impact if we're not embodying the message we're trying to impart to the world. So it's about congruency. I think that sums it up.
Be the change. Mm. Take care, everyone.
Thank you, man. That's awesome.